Good morning. It looks like we have all the parties that would expect to be present. We have council for at least two councils, so I'm assuming each side is represented. We have the other two judges, Ross and Reyes. I'm Judge Sleater presiding in this virtual Court of Appeals proceeding on June 10. This is the third of our three oral matters on our calendar this morning. We also have three non-oral matters we will later be considering. This is file A19-1797. Lynette Lynn Cadwell versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. So even though we're proceeding virtually, the process otherwise is the same, meaning that the appellant and respondent will each have 15 minutes to give their argument and answer questions, and then appellant will have 5 minutes in response for rebuttal if you wish. We do ask that you identify yourself for the record because we are recording these proceedings as a standard procedure. Jason Heikkinen, the law clerk who's marshaling, will have his phone in front of his camera so you'll be able to see the timing. If at any time you discern you're not being heard, cannot hear, cannot be seen or see, let us know and we'll try to correct the problem. So far this morning, so good. And so if counsel for appellant is ready to proceed, you may. You are muted, Mr. Hogan. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Sorry about that. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Barry Hogan, Hogen. I represent the petitioner appellant Lynette Marie Cadwell with regards to this matter. I'm going to hopefully not use anywhere near the 15 minutes. This case presents a very simple question, and that is, what is the quantum of evidence? And by quantum, I mean quality of the evidence, type of evidence, and the nature of the evidence necessary to establish the emergency aid exception to the warrant requirement. The legal standard is quite straightforward. First, whether there's reasonable grounds to believe that there is an emergency and immediate need for assistance for protection of life or property. The second prong of that test is reasonable basis approximating probable cause to associate the emergency with the area or place to be searched. You know, various case law have held the emergency aid exception applying. In Rice v. State, there was a 911 call of a man in an apartment with a gun. Police responded, went into the apartment, found the individual passed out on a couch, turned him over, pulled a gun out from behind him, and he was eventually charged with felon in possession of a handgun. Another case, an officer arrived at a home of a suspect where a murder occurred half a block away. The window screen was torn, the window was pushed up, unlatched, looked like it'd been jimmied, and the door was open, and the officers felt there was a burglary. And in that case, State v. Lemieux, 726 Northwest, 2nd, 783, the officers entered.
Mr. Hagan, yeah, can I take you completely off the rails for a moment? We have the authority to affirm a decision of the district court on any ground. I'm curious as to whether how this case would have been presented or what would have happened if the argument made by the state was simply hot pursuit, that reasonable suspicion of an offense was decided upon before your client began entering her garage, and the officer then followed her into the garage. I mean, if the officer initiated a traffic stop and she walked into her garage, I think you would agree with you that he could walk into the garage after her under that doctrine.
That would be much worse facts from our side. That is correct. And in this specific case, and it's, you know, one of the officer went into the driveway, and specifically if he had turned his lights on while the petitioner was doing her driving conduct, yes, that doctrine would apply and it would be much worse facts for our case. But those are not the facts in this case. You know, there in implied consent proceedings, there's a requirement the petitioner has to state with specificity what the issues are. I wish in criminal cases and in implied consent cases, whenever the Fourth Amendment is involved, the state would have to state with specificity what exception to the warrant requirement they were relying on in order to justify the entry into a home. And yes, if the lights had been turned on in the squad car, that's a totally different factual situation. For whatever reason, the officer did not do that. And so therefore there's no hot pursuit. And that was not argued in the trial court.
Even if the lights were turned on, we might deem it as hot pursuit, whether the officer turned his lights on or not. But the last point you made is one that is, I think, of greater significance, I suppose, to me in my theorizing about what this case might have looked like, which is that the state never presented that as the basis for the exception to the warrant requirement.
To be honest, in this case, these cases are real facts specific. The Halipole case cited by the from 1991 from this court, as an individual is driving a car very erratically, stops in the middle of the road, is out in the medium, good Samaritan stop, the person's incoherent, and it was justified to enter the house in that situation. The other case relied on the state is the unpublished decision, which is very close facts of this case, with one and the most important fact being that the officer saw the individual sitting in a garage, slumped over, passed out, leaned forward. And so I believe that would be a more significant fact leading to the application of the emergency aid exception.
Can I inquire? Is it my understanding that from the testimony of the officer, that the evidence for the officer's opinion there may be a medical issue did not arise until observing the conduct in the garage with the car? And secondly, what deference do we give to the judge's findings that evidence was sufficient to consider a medical emergency?
I think the trial court's factual findings obviously have great deference. I don't think there's any dispute as to what they are. The transcript on pages 5, 6, and 7 in direct, there was a 911 call, believed following impaired driver. The only information was they were impaired, wasn't a lot of information transmitted over the radio, the officer testified to. And then a question was on page 7, and have you found that can be associated with anything? And the officer's response, it's often associated with impaired driving, whether it's alcohol use, drug use, or a medical condition. That is, even before they're near the officer made that determination based solely on the tip that there is a medical condition, and that's on that page. And of course, the officer at that point had said that there was not a lot of radio communication, but then on cross-examination, page 12, I asked, your report does not indicate at all what the driving conduct was, does it? Answer, I don't believe so. Question, okay, how did you find out what the driving conduct was? Answer, the information was given to me over the radio by dispatch. Okay, what information was weaving within the lane, crossing the center line? What was it? Officer's answer, I guess I'm not positive, just that there was some weaving. I believe they crossed the line were the details. And so what the facts are in this case is, and it wasn't in the police report, was that a caller thought they saw an impaired driving driver was weaving in their lane and crossed the center line once, which is significant less than the Halipole decision. And I think that goes to why I said quantum of evidence, what type of evidence? Because really the evidence here, and I'm arguing the legal conclusion drawn by the court on the conclusion, which is de novo review, the evidence, the character of all of the evidence is based on the officer's training and experience. There were no facts to suggest there was any type of medical condition. It's going back to the transcript, the officer's first testimony. Whenever I have a call like this, it's an impaired driver, drugs or alcohol or drugs, or possibly a medical condition. And I think if this was a test case and I was arguing that, the observation period wasn't good enough, without evidence of that, everyone would tell me it's speculative. And I think that's what the evidence is here. It's speculative. It is a blanket rule that any time there is a tip from a being called in that an individual is, I think, impaired with weaving and crossing the center line. If it's just impaired, they might not have enough to even stop the vehicle, but it's enough to enter the house if the officer says medical exception, because that's a possibility, a speculative possibility. And I think that's what the nature of the evidence is here. There's no real hard facts at any point of a medical condition. In fact, the driving conduct, the court has access to the video. I don't know that anyone's seen it. It's a large truck going into a small garage, and it bumps a recycling bin in the garage. And the officer thought he saw tracks that had maybe hit the garage earlier. The best speculation on that is this is a drunk driver, not that there's a medical condition. And, if the officer had turned the lights on when he saw that driving conduct rather than getting out and entering the garage, it's a different case. And that is our position, is the quantum of evidence. What is the quality of evidence? The quality of evidence here is essentially based on the officer's training and experience. I have probable cause. Whenever I get a phone call that someone's crossed the center line once and they weave within their lane. And I don't believe that fits the constitutional standards. I do not believe that fits the medical exception. I think there has to be some solid facts specific to this case to assume that there is a medical condition. And I do not believe that was in the record here. There's a lot of talk these days about inequality in the system. And I think one of the things is we all want to believe police officers, but I don't think an officer's training and experience should be probable cause life evidence as is necessary.
Mr. Hogan, I have a question for you along those lines. In the other cases that you cite, the Halipo case and others, what was the specific medical condition there?
I don't know that the Halipo case is the one that's the closest. What it was is, but the person was incoherent and barely conscious, stumbling around on a median. On this case, the officer enters the garage immediately, and the state very eloquently states what is said on the video on page 3 in their fact situation. How you doing? Good. But the officer is already walking into the garage at that point. And in all those cases, there's a little difference, the burglary case or the gun case, the cases I cited, those are obviously emergency aid exception in a crime situation where there are specific facts to that case showing that there's crime afoot. In the one case, Lemieux, I believe, there's a murder a half block away and they think the suspect is in this address and they see the address broken into. And the other case is rendering aid to someone in a home, a female and her child, and the female is afraid for her child because there's a guy in the apartment with a gun. The Halipo case, there's no real articulation. And that case is from 1991, is from this court rather than the Supreme Court where the other cases are from. But it's a person stopped their car in the middle of a street, busy street, just stopped it, was stumbling around the median, and other people then took that person home and were concerned for their welfare. I think at that point, there's enough evidence to assume this person is intoxicated to the level that their life is in danger, but I do not believe that evidence is here in this case, if that answers the question.
Thank you, counsel.
And of course, the other unpublished case was the officer has a tip very similar to this case. The officer shows up at the house, sees that individual parked in the garage, a slumper. Is he unconscious, essentially unconscious, or asleep in the car? That's not the case here. My client gets out of the car and the officer, how you doing? Good. And that, and I don't think those questions, that's just normal, what people would say when they see each other, as opposed to, I'm making a medical determination based upon these answers. But the officer was already walking in the garage when those questions were asked. And all these cases are extremely fact specific. I think the McNeely case and the application of exigent circumstances to DWI shows that. For 30, 40 years, everyone was under the impression that the dissipation of alcohol was a exigent circumstance per se, and all of a sudden, lo and behold, we were all wrong. And it's very fact specific, and the facts are what matter to an application. And the danger of the application and conclusion of those facts to this case is there is not a situation where a police officer cannot open a window of a home. Anytime there is a call in saying a car is weaving in its lane, an officer can go in the home because they can always say, well, you know, might be diabetes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hogan. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Melcioni, and I represent the respondent commissioner in this matter. This case is really about whether an officer that has a legitimate and reasonable ground to believe that a driver is in need of medical assistance may step into an open garage after seeing the vehicle strike multiple items.
I don't think that's the question. The question isn't whether an officer who believes has reason to believe there's a medical condition can go into a garage. I think that's settled law. The question is whether the facts of this case would suggest such a medical emergency exists. And I have to tell you, in all of the cases I've seen, not just in Minnesota, but all over the country, federal and state, applying the emergency aid exception, just to put my cards on the table, I've never seen a case of emergency aid affirmed with facts so thin as this one, suggesting some medical condition. Have you found a case?
I think the unpublished Hudson case would be the closest.
No, published cases that actually have binding precedent, that cases that we rely upon as authoritative. Did you find any?
Halipo would be the closest published case. And
you recognize how this case is distinguished factually from that one, I assume.
I do recognize how this case is distinguished factually from Halipo, but I don't think that this case is so distinguished that the outcome should be any different.
Well, why don't you tell me, what's the most compelling indicia of a medical condition or a medical emergency in this case? What are the facts that would most compellingly lead someone to conclude that Ms. Caldwell is suffering from a medical emergency?
I think the manner in which she attempted to enter the garage, the officer testified that there had been, and the district court credited the testimony, that it appeared that the vehicle had struck the garage, struck several garbage cans, had backed up and tried to re-enter the garage, and then upon re-entry struck either the garage or something in the garage. But I think what's most compelling is the appellant's reaction after what is apparently the third vehicle strike. Instead of backing out and trying to readjust, she accelerated and push through whatever the object is into her garage. And you can see this on the video. You can hear the engine.
Wait a second. So why would that tell an officer that she's suffering from a medical condition as opposed to this is a typical drunk driver? Everything you've just described is exactly the sort of thing an officer looks to see whether there's an impaired individual. I'm trying to get a sense of what then takes the officer to the next step that, I'm dealing with a diabetic.
And I think there are two responses to that. First, as the Supreme Court has held, it's not necessary that the medical emergency be the sole motivating factor. The officer can have a dual motivation in entry, but
what's the medical part? I want to know what's the medical part here. If I'm a neighbor looking at this, I don't think, oh my gosh, Ms. Caldwell is having a, I've got to call 911 and get the ambulance here. It doesn't occur to me that would be my first concern or secondary concern. And it doesn't seem as if it was the officer's first or secondary concern, because according to the district court said that the sergeant, quote, was concerned that the driver was impaired by alcohol, number one, or other substance, number two, or was having a medical issue.
And again, I don't think the case law says that it needs to be the first or even the second concern. You can, an officer can have many concerns, but so long as the emergency aid concern is one of the motivating factors, the entry should be upheld. In this case, I think the officer had significant concerns based upon that additional driving conduct. If you look at pages 9 to 10 of the transcript, where the officer testifies that this driving conduct in his experience can be typical of someone who is impaired or having a medical issue. And I think that brings us back to Halipo and...
Can't every officer in the country say that about every single person he's following who's weaving in the road? Couldn't the officer say, well, it could be drunk driving or it could be a medical emergency? Couldn't you say that about every single case?
And no, I don't think that you can say that about every single case. If you were dealing with solely driving conduct, I think this would be a different case.
It's driving conduct on the road and driving conduct trying to park a car. Isn't that all we have is driving conduct?
But it's not just the driving conduct on the road. I think the repeated vehicle strikes of the garage make this a very different case. And if you, looking back to the Halipo and particularly the Hudson case, when trying to analogize to the facts of those cases, the Hudson case would lead us to the conclusion that the officer needs to wait until she passes out to render aid when she could be having a walking stroke or a walking diabetic seizure.
Counsel, let me stop you there, because I think you hit upon one of the key factual differences between this case and the other cases like Halipo, where the people there are unconscious. And here you've got, in Halipo, I should say, you had extensive testimony of a Good Samaritan where the person couldn't walk or talk, and they expressed their concern that she would not even be able to take care of herself. Here you have an officer who, like Judge Ross stated, all you see is driving conduct. And the only thing that the officer sees after the driving conduct, which would indicate driving under the influence of something, is when he approaches the garage and says hello, and she says hello, and then he enters the garage. So that's another key factual difference here, is she's conscious and she's talking. So if that's the case, what is his justification to go into the garage? Why not ask, well, are you okay? Are you feeling okay? Is there anything wrong? Do you need medical attention? Before entering the garage, it just doesn't seem like there's enough compared to all the case law that's out there.
Well, and that is the first thing he asked upon taking, I think it was 2 steps into the garage, if you watch the video.
Right.
And if you see the positioning of the truck, I think it would have been very hard for him to continue that conversation from behind this red pickup truck where petitioner was getting out of the driver's side. He said hello. He said hello, police department. She said hello. That's when he takes 1 step inside, and his next immediate question is, how you doing? She says, good. And then he immediately explains why he's there and continues, as is one of the considerations to be had under Reese, Lemieux, and Uthed, is did the officer proceed as though he were checking on a medical emergency? He immediately explained why he was there and then asked, I just want to make sure you're doing okay. And they have a conversation that where she then does say she's fine. But at that point, all the indicia are already apparent that she's impaired.
Okay, but that gets back to, well, first of all, I still don't understand why he needed to enter the garage. But that gets back to Judge Ross's question that I don't think has been answered, is what is her specific medical condition?
The officer's testimony says that the most common medical condition where he sees this type of behavior is diabetes and someone having a diabetic episode. That would be on pages, I think it's 8 and then 9 through 10 specifically.
Right. I understand that. I'm familiar with the record. But what is the specific, other than his statement that, which sounds very speculative, well, she could have been diabetic. What is the indicia that she is suffering from diabetes and requires immediate medical attention? That there is an immediate need as the Reese case says, there needs to be an immediate need for assistance.
It is solely that parking conduct where she powers through whatever object she has just hit with her truck.
But that's driving. And I think conduct. That's the most. That's driving conduct. That's not an indication of how is she responding. Is she, for instance, when people are diabetic, you'll start to, there's kind of an incoherence and an inconsistency in what they're saying and what they're doing. Is there any indication in the record from what she said to the officer to indicate that she is indeed suffering from diabetes, having a diabetic attack, having an insulin reaction?
Well, no. Once the officer entered, he was able to ascertain fairly quickly that that was not what was happening. But until he entered, it was impossible for him to say she wasn't having this medical emergency.
So there wasn't a medical emergency there. And he could have asked her from two steps back then, correct?
That's a factual determination that I don't think the record can distinguish. And I think once you watch the video, you can see that he was really coming around the side of the car and didn't come very far, but just so he could have that conversation.
Well, it may not be that far. It may only be one step, but you're talking about one step into a person's home, which enjoys greater protection than if somebody's out on the road in the car. So
agreed,
that one
but
step
this
is very, very significant. It's one giant step here for the police officers.
It is. And that step is certainly constitutionally significant, but it goes to the question of whether or not he could have had that conversation from two steps back, considering the positioning of the truck in that garage. From the video, I don't know that he could have had that conversation in a meaningful way from outside the threshold of the garage.
Well, Mr. Malcioni, go ahead. Well, I was going to actually steal a bit of Judge Ross's thunder. I wanted to go back to the hypothetical he asked Mr. Hogan, and would you agree with Mr. Hogan's response that without conceding, which you're not, of course, that the facts, the law would have been better for the officer under a fresh pursuit DUI as opposed to medical emergency?
It would have certainly been more clear. Yeah, there's no multi-factor test there. It would have been certainly more straightforward analysis if it had been hot pursuit. But for whatever reason, the officer did not activate his emergency lights, which supports that he was not entering for an investigative purpose, but was going to render aid. Because if it were solely investigative, there's no reason for him not to activate those emergency lights.
So am I correct, Ms. Melcioni? It's not enough for the officer to believe that she might have a medical condition. He has to perceive that she has a medical condition that requires immediate emergency aid. Is that correct? Do you agree with that?
And the officer's testimony supports that based upon his experience, he's been an officer since 2003, that if this behavior is indicative of a diabetic episode as opposed to intoxication, that person would be in need of immediate aid.
Why? I mean, most people who are diabetic, at least if they're functioning and they're coherent, they're aware and can administer their own medical aid. I mean, they can provide themselves the shots they need. I'm trying to get a sense of, so let's assume she was having some medical condition. Why is it an emergency condition?
Because based upon the conduct observed up to that point, she may not be able to care for herself or make those appropriate decisions, because she clearly decided, you know, instead of backing out of her garage after she hit something, to floor the accelerator and power through it. So
just to be clear, she couldn't have floored the accelerator. She might have sped up or she might have kept going, but I mean, we know what cars do to garages if the car is if it's floored. Even a car with minor power wouldn't just bump into a garbage can.
And again, I don't know exactly what was causing the impediment on the side of the truck, but whatever it was, whether it was floored or not, on the video, I think you can hear the engine revving in a significant manner, and then the truck jostles to get over or through whatever she is pushing, which indicates she is either unaware of what just happened, which is concerning, or she is in such a rush to get home, maybe she is having an emergency that she needs assistance with. And I think the officer took all of those factors into consideration and did behave.
When you say you think he took those into consideration, the record doesn't tell us he took those things into consideration. You're speculating, aren't you?
I think the record does support that he took those into consideration on 9 through 10, where he talks about the difficulty parking and how that was a concern, that again, she was either impaired or having a medical issue. And then the follow-up question is, you were concerned she was having a medical issue, and he says, that was one of the things I was considering.
Well,
so he was certainly front of mind. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I don't want to keep beating the horse.
So I see that my time is about to expire. Unless there are other questions, we request that the court affirm the district court's sustain order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Melchione. And Mr. Hogan, you would have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Your Honor, I would waive rebuttal unless any members of the court have questions for me.
Looks like there are no questions. Very well. Thank you, Mr. Hogan. Mr. Melchione, we appreciate your comments today and answers to our questions and your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement. Thank you also for the patience during our digital virtual, which seemed to virtually go well as far as I can tell. So thank you both. Have a good day.
Thank you.